start over.
It's always better than starting late. All right. So, as was covered last class, beginning in 1965, American war efforts in Vietnam were changing. Powers that be convinced President LBJ to Americanize the war. Essentially, American soldiers, Marines, Army men would replace the Republic of Vietnam's forces, the ARVN, and would begin combat operations aimed at targeting and destroying the Viet Cong. The full scope was that 44 battalion request by General Westmoreland. And, as we left off, the only way to reach that request, increasing the American presence in Vietnam by over 100,000, was with a draft. Now, as we know, at least I know, the Selective Service was created during World War II, but it wasn't used in World War II. But it would be used in Korea. And then after Korea, you had that peacetime draft. So the draft was there, the draft was in operation. And of course, all males had to register for Selective Service 18 to 65, but they would not be allowed to do things like vote. Still true today. It would be the draft that LBJ would use to basically get the 44 divisions, or 44 battalions, as requested by Westmoreland. All right, how would this work? Well, simple. Simple, 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 simple. The president would set forth a number. And in 1965, he called for a total draft class of 230,000 men. Then, beginning in 1966 and going all the way to 1969, that number would increase to 300,000 men. These draftees would have to report and be trained in military service. Wait, that's not this one. But that didn't necessarily mean that all those boots would be deployed in country in Vietnam. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. Now the sad part was that when you actually look at the draftees beginning in 65, it was largely the poor. It was largely the working class families that saw their sons go into the military. Why? Well, because of the rules. If your number was called, you had to serve unless you could get a deferment. Essentially, your draft would be waived. How? Well, if you had physical problems, you were not conscripted into the military. If you had mental problems, you were not conscripted into the military. If you were married with children, you would not be drafted into the military. Ironically, if you were in college, you could get a deferment. Or if you could prove that you needed to stay at home to support their families, that was the other way you could get a deferment. So ultimately, who got deferments? Wealthy people. Because wealthy people could afford to go to college. Now, ironically, there are many American political figures in politics today and over the last few decades who famously were able to get deferments. Bill Clinton got a deferment. He dodged the draft by going to college. Joe Biden, Dick Cheney, yes, even President Donald J. Trump. Interestingly enough, though, out of all the ways traditionally to get a deferment, there was an exception if you got married. So a lot of guys, when they would get their draft cards, would go out and get married to avoid going into the draft. But LBJ would tweak those rules, and that's the reason why previously I said married with children. If you were the sole income provider, and you had a child at home prior to getting drafted, so you couldn't go knock your girlfriend up. As long as you were married and had kids when the draft card arrived, you would not have to go into the draft. Now, some guys got creative. Because way back in 1965, there was in the draft and military rules an interesting section of the code of conduct called Section 8. Section 8 is reserved to the men who are, let's just say, more effeminate than they are masculine. Up until the 1980s, homosexuality was considered a mental disability. So there were a lot of guys that basically pretended to be gay so they didn't have to go into the military. And of course, yes, some fled to Mexico, some went to Canada. But the overwhelming majority of the men who were drafted did serve. Now, some were also like my father. My father was eligible to be drafted when he graduated from high school. But he had some buddies that were a year older than him. So while he was in his senior year, they got drafted. And he basically decided, screw that, I'm not going to get drafted. So he went and enlisted in the Marines before graduation because he had a feeling he was going to go anyways. So if you were drafted, the military told you what branch you were going into. He, because he enlisted, could actually pick where he wanted to go. Now, even though we're not at Nixon yet, I'm just going to finish up the discussion of the draft here. When, spoiler alert, 1968 presidential election, Richard Nixon won. When he became president in 1969, one of the first things that he did was he tweaked the draft. Because there was a lot of people criticizing the way it was run under LBJ. Particularly, it was blatantly obvious that the poor were disproportionately forced to go into the military. So, to make it more fair, he implemented what became known as the draft lottery. And the first draft was pulled on December 1st, 1969. Whereas previously, you would be drafted based upon your selective service number, the new draft would be based on year of birth. So, you take a calendar. Calendar year has 365 days. Into a bucket was put 366, just in case there was a leap year, dates in a blue pill that went into a deep glass container. And then the capsules would be drawn by hand. And if your birth date was chosen, you'd be drafted. On December 1st, the very first capsule that was drafted was September 14th. So, any man born between 1944 and 1950, making them 19 to 25, on September 14th, congratulations, son, you were drafted. They continued to go until they filled the ranks. I didn't go through all the numbers, but the second date chosen, April 24th. But what they did is they went all the way through, and each date had a number, 1 to 366. And from those, that's how they chose. Because they looked at how many people were born between 1944 and 1950 on September 14th. What are the chances? Probably got like 10,000. All right, the next date in year, okay, maybe this 25,000. They kept going until they got 300,000. The moment they got to 300,000, they stopped. Here's the chart. This was the one that was done on 1970, because they did it 1970, they did it 1971, and then they stopped on 1973. So I like this because what I did was I said, okay, my birthday is on October 3rd. So if I was alive and born on the years that were associated with this on October 3rd, chances are I'm not going in, because I would get a number 244. If under this new system you were drafted on December 1st, you had to report to a military facility on February 1st, 1970. This first draft class made up of the first 30 birth dates drawn. And by the way, over the next three drafts that this draft system was used, it never exceeded more than 30. So if you had a low number, 30 or lower, you're going to get drafted. 40s, 50s, 60s, anything higher, you are safe. The draft would remain in place until President Nixon suspended the draft on January 27th, 1973. Now in total, through use of the draft, beginning in 1964 all the way up until it was stopped in 1973, 27 million men were eligible to be drafted. But only 2.2 million would be drafted. So that's what? That's less than 10%. Maybe about 8%. In total, of those 27 million men, 15.4 were granted deferments. Mostly for education. There was some mental, there was some physical, some family hardships. FYI, even if I would have been drafted, not that I was live during this time period, although actually, no, I was. I was born, but I don't think they're going to pull into the military. Kid was one, two. But I would not have been able to serve. I would have gotten a medical deferment. Because when I was 17 years old, I was going to follow in my father's boots and I was going to join the Marine Corps. I was a physical specimen. I was a machine. I was going to be a Marine. Hoorah, Semper Fi. passed the physical with flying colors. One of the highest that did the test when I did it. Then once I passed the physical, I started getting all the medical tests. And you know what I found out? I am significantly tone deaf in my right ear. If you cannot hear tones, you cannot take orders. And the Marine Corps doesn't want you. So I was not able to serve, even though I wanted to volunteer. Now, in total, if you watch any of the hippie culture stuff, the counterculture stuff from the 1960s, they make a big deal out about how many draft dodgers there were. Well, 2.2 million men went into the military for the draft. Roughly only 200,000. Actually, the actual number is 209,517 did not show up. Where did they go? Some went to Canada, some went to Mexico. And of those drafted, 100,000 reported, but deserted. So essentially that means a little over 300,000 were drafted and did not serve. Questions on the draft? All right, well, now we have the means to put the boots on the ground. Oh, I didn't know I did the stats. All right, there we go. Oh, look at me. Perfect. Good. You want those? Can if you want. It was my bad. I should have clicked. I didn't have them marked as they were clicking. Snapped it. Well, now we have these soldiers. Now the nature of the war is going to change in the Republic of Vietnam. In charge of all military operations was General Westmoreland. He would set the strategy based upon traditional, conventional tactics. In other words, we're going to fight a World War II / Korean War type of war. We're going to unleash large-scale, big-unit operations. We're going to use tanks. We're going to use helicopters. We're going to use artillery. We're going to use air support. Large-scale bombing runs. And the plan? Search and destroy missions. We're going to fly out into the remote parts of South Vietnam. And we're going to attack the enemy where they are. And we are going to inflict so many casualties on the VC and the NVAs that they're going to give up. Because if you are suffering casualty rates, 80, 85, 90% of your unit strength, you can't fight. And who is going to fight for you, knowing what is going to happen to them? But how are they going to do it? The French were never able to penetrate inland. Well, new tactics. We're not going to use the ARVN methods. We're not going to use the French methods. No rah. No way. We're going to use American methods. We are going to deploy American soldiers, American Marines. These men will protect, first and foremost, the air bases. Because air operations are going to be crucial. Because remember how the French lost the Indochinese War? They had to rely on roads. Well, by using superior air force, you don't have to worry about roads. The roads are the skies.
Then, once we deploy our soldiers to protect our bases, we are going to get sending out
mobile units to go find the enemy, wherever they may be. That's stage two.
And then once we find where the enemy is, we are going to kill them all.
We will destroy any units that are found. We will destroy their bases of operation. And in the end, victory for America. Well, how is this going to be done? Well, Westmoreland admitted it would take work.
He estimated 3.5 years tops.
Well, his report comes back to the Pentagon. And the Pentagon looks at this timetable. And they determine it to be reasonable. I mean, after all, it took us 3.5 years to beat the Germans. It took us 3.5 years to beat the Japanese. Vietnam is a little more complicated. Different fighting conditions. But it would be reasonable to assume if we could beat the Nazis and the Japs, we could beat the VC. Plus, the Pentagon had full faith in Westmoreland. They viewed him as the most capable commander of his day. He was the Eisenhower. He was, I don't know, all the great generals that we've had in the past. Well, once the Pentagon did its assessment, they then passed it over to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And ultimately, the Joint Chiefs trusted Westmoreland. They viewed this like every other war in recent American history. It would be a war of movement and attack. Of course, the VC, we're not going to fight that type of war, but shh. Questions? Well, with the draft, soon ships began crossing the Pacific, holding men and materiel, and these troops would be deployed in country. And man, oh man, I'm sure any bystander on the street watching our boys parading down to the military bases, hundreds of thousands in their khaki greenish uniforms, deployment of tanks, deployment of military air superiority. Must have been awesome in every sense of the word. Now, ironically, the timing was ideal because going back to the end of Eisenhower's administration and all through Kennedy's administration, the military had been in the process of being rebuilt and re-equipped to fight the new types of wars. Give you a classic example. The M4 battle rifle was replaced with the M16. The old prop planes were replaced by jets. And why did these changes occur? Well, we talked about this. JFK, he wanted to be able to respond to any outbreaks of communist activity anywhere in the world. So you wouldn't need large occupying armies, but rather you needed quickly deployed mobile forces.
And most importantly,
the officers, the leadership, had faith in the mission. They believed in the cause, this anti-communist crusade, and they believed in their weapons. And lastly, they believed in the combat skills of the American warrior. Just wearing the stars and stripes on their uniform, the leaders believed that the men would be supercharged to win, because that's what America does. General George S. Patton once famously said, "Americans don't like losers, because Americans are winners." And the classic attitude of all of this was a newly developed specialized force for operations in Vietnam. The Air Cav. The 1st Cavalry Air Division. This specialized unit would be the first military unit in history to utilize as its platform helicopters. And these helicopters would be flown by some of the most highly trained and skilled pilots in the U.S. Armed Forces. They flew helicopters for troop deployment. They flew helicopters for medevac operations. They flew helicopters to continue to resupply men with munitions and food and supplies anywhere in the country. And they also operated attack helicopters armed with Gatling guns and precision missiles. It would be these men who would bring the war to the enemy. But there was a problem. And this problem would be the flaw that would eventually expose the 1st Cav. This unit was created to have the ability to get to the most remote places in Vietnam, literally into the mountains and the jungles. And it was built on the assumption that if a major war erupted, they could bring in reserve units. But the problem was, the Air Cav was new, and there was no reserve. So, if one of the 435 helicopters got shot down, how long would it take to replace, not just the helicopter, but the highly trained men who flew them? A year? 2 years? And then what's going to happen when the next helicopter gets shot down and the next helicopter gets shot down? Essentially, if the war erupted too quick, the Air Cav would not be capable of responding. Questions? All right, let's make this America's war. The very first phase of Americanization began in late August 1965. This big war push would be codenamed Operation Starlight. If you ever see a veteran on Memorial Day or Veterans Day in uniform, and they look kind of old, and they have this colored bar on their rack, that's a ribbon, an award ribbon, given to the men who are involved in this particular operation. This was the first purely American operation in the Vietnam War. The ARVN would not be involved. The plan was simple. Located just north of Da Nang was this peninsula right here. And as you can see on this peninsula, that overhead picture, the United States had built an air base near the tiny fishing village of Chau Lai. The problem was going back to that assault beginning by the VC of targeting bases, they had committed a couple of strikes at the air base. Of course, they would be pushed out, they would be held off. But this was very concerning to Westmoreland. So the plan was simple. We're going to find where the VC are, and we're going to secure our perimeters. The operation would begin with preemptive strikes on a massive scale. M155 M1 howitzers would begin bombarding areas of suspected VC activity. Hundreds, thousands of shells were fired. And on top of it, 20 Marine A4s and F4s began dropping bombs. 18 tons, as well as napalm to open up landing zones in the area where the VC were. Then the Marines would be deployed from naval vessels in an amphibious landing, similar to D-Day. Most of the vehicles were armored personnel carriers, and they headed towards the beaches. These dots are all Vietnamese fishing boats. In total, these LVTP-5s, which are those landing vehicles, they carried 30 men in it per vehicle. And they also used LCMs, landing craft mechanized units, which were capable of transporting M48 tanks. They also had three M67 flamethrower tanks in there as well. So they brought troops and they brought armor. Then once they were on the shores, they fanned out in a sweeping arc all throughout the countryside. And they began striking VC targets. Now the VC did fight back. For 3 hours, Marines and VC would clash. In total, 614 VC were killed, 42 were captured. 45 Marines would be killed. But you know something? The VC didn't retreat. They simply slipped away. They disappeared into the jungle. In his report, General William E. DePue said, and I quote, "The VC maneuvered into the jungle. They maintained tactical integrity. They withdrew their wounded. They lost practically no weapons. And they did a first-class job. Of course, we're proud of the American troops as well, who did better. But you know what they expected? They expected the VC to drop their guns and surrender at the showing of force. But the VC did not. They fought until the last minute. They tried killing as many Americans as they could. And then they slipped away. They didn't run away. They slipped away. That should have been a warning sign. But it was not. Heeded. Questions? One month later, the first significant engagement of large-scale forces would take place. In the Battle of Yitrang Valley. Might have been the late 90s or early 2000s. Mel Gibson did a movie about this event. It's called When We Were Soldiers. Good movie. Good flick. And Mel Gibson, not only did he star in it, he wrote it, he directed it, and he did so with the assistance of the leaders that were actually there. So if any of you are looking to do those extra credit papers, it's a good movie to do. It's an excellent, excellent movie. Because it is arguably one of the most accurate visual showings of what Vietnam was like. The plan was simple. Beginning on October 19th, the AirCav would, I don't know if you can see the little map here, this is not quite down at the butt bulge of South Vietnam. This is kind of like where Vietnam curves up, but it's into the interior along the Laotian and Cambodian border. Yitrang Valley is a very isolated valley. It's very rural. There's no major roads to get to. But the VC had been acting in the region with impunity. Unbeknownst to the Americans, they also built a mega base by digging into one of the mountains that overlooked the valley. The base itself had the capacity to hold somewhere close to 10,000 men. But, based on reconnaissance, they knew the VC were active. So beginning on October 19th, F-4s, A-5s began flying out and they began bombarding an area of terrain, blowing up all of the trees in a wide perimeter. They also used napalm as well. Burn everything down. This would be the LZ. Once the ground was properly prepared, the plan was to deploy American soldiers, fight them head on, and beat them. Now, ironically, this should have been enlightening like the Battle of Ak Bak, which we talked about, where the ARVN came into the rice paddies and they basically got bogged down because the VC controlled the perimeter and basically shot down helicopters, kept them trapped. This should have been a warning sign on what was to come. But of course, the lessons of history were ignored.
Why? Well, because unlike at Opbach, where the ARVN clashed with VC, in this battle, they wouldn't be fighting VC. Unbeknownst to the Americans, they would actually fight North Vietnamese regulars, professionally trained soldiers, armed with the latest Chinese weapons. Gone were the SKSs, and in their hands were AK-47s.
Now, I've already talked about this click, talked about the fact that the French never got there, even though this had long been a sanctuary for communists.
But here's the other last point. The officers that were there were all experienced. They were all combat veterans. They all had fought in the Indochinese War. They learned how to fight by fighting the French. They understood Western-style tactics.
So they knew at some point, because of advanced technology, the Americans would find out where they were. And like I said, they were digging this massive base into a mountain because they knew at some point they would come and they would be ready for it. In fact, some of the letters that survived from the VC side, or sorry, the NVA side, the officers will say, bring it on. We want to show that we can fight them. Ultimately, they knew if they could kill enough Americans, that would scare the American people, the American mind. So the NVA were willing to pour everything on the line, even killing their last soldiers, just to learn intelligence. All right. Well, as I said, spoilers, they found the base, they prepared the LZ. And then on November 14th, 1965, the character which Mel Gibson played was this man,
Colonel Harold G. Moore,
commander of the 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry. His battalion consisted of 450 men. And on this day, they were all flown into the landing zone. The helicopters came in, dropped low, the men jumped out, feigned out, started making their perimeter lines. The one thing they did not know was when the enemy would attack. So, in hopes of gaining that intelligence, once the LZ was secured, once more lined up fire support, had the guys dig in little trenches, had guys, you know, peering the trees along the lines, he soon began sending out patrols, hoping to detect and possibly disrupt enemy activity. But as it was shown, what happened is a lot of those patrols got separated. They got encircled. They got pinned down. And by the end of the first day, Moore knew that trouble was coming. Because beginning on the second day, November 15th, the NVA did something that Moore would have never in his wildest dreams would have ever done. Again, it's shown in the movie. They started launching human wave assaults. hundreds of NVA came running down the hills from their defensive positions in the mountain. Wave after wave of men hoping to overwhelm the enemy. Then, when the Americans were nearly exhausted on day three, the NVA sent another wave. By November 16th, the battlefield was littered with bodies. Now, in all honesty, the 1st Battalion enjoyed a 10-to-1 killing ratio. The Americans suffered 80 KIAs to the over 1,000 NVA. Because if you're running downhill at a guy that's dug in and sitting there just going plink, 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 it's like shooting fish in a barrel. But that's not to say the American lines almost didn't break. Moore himself barely survived getting himself killed, which would have made him the highest ranking casualty of the war. His death, with his name, his reputation, could have been devastating. So, Westmoreland sent the order. Moore had to get pulled out. Now, if you watch the movie, that's where the movie ends. But truth be told, the battle didn't end there. Whoop, I screwed up that PowerPoint. Because, by the way the movie makes it portrayed, that Colonel Moore would not leave, that he was the first boot on the ground on the battlefield, and he would be the last boot to leave. It's not really how it played out. As Moore flew back with the wounded, more units continued to pour in. Two more fresh battalions, another 900 men, would arrive. These units would replace the 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry. 2nd Battalion, 5th Cavalry was commanded by Lieutenant Bob Tully. And 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry was commanded by Colonel McDade, Robert McDade. These men were ordered in to bring a victory. Moore softened them up. They were going to deliver the finishing blow. But right out of the gates, they made a huge blunder. Once they were dropped off at the LZ, codename X-Ray, believing the landing zone to be secure, they went out and they split up. Tully traveled in a northeasterly direction. He was to make a route of those 4-mile trek to sweep the area of enemy. While at the same time, Colonel McDade was to travel 4 miles in a north by northeast direction.
Well, they're both kind of going north.
Yeah, the problem is that north by northeast, it's kind of like this. So you're kind of going north, but you start an angle a little bit.
versus Northeast? So this means the farther they get away from the landing zone, the farther they are from one another. So if an enemy strikes them, it's harder to get support. Now, what's the big deal? The big deal is simple. McDade, even though he outranked Tully, McDade was a desk officer. At least Tully had served in Korea. He had battlefield experience. So the problem was McDade, because he did not actually have battlefield experience, he allowed his men and his officers to kind of relax. They kind of didn't maintain tight groupings. The guys were kind of talking out loud to one another. They didn't establish, you know, scouts going wider than the group. And what was the problem? Well, they were going through a field that had what was called elephant grass, which was as high as an average man's top of his chest. So you're sitting there walking through the grass, kind of talking, shooting the shit. Your voice travels. The enemy, you gotta know where you are. And that's essentially what happened. McDade would walk into an ambush. The VC, all short, all camouflaged, rather the NVA, they watched the progress. They knew where they were going. And at the point when McDade was out of voice distance from Tully, they set up a U-shaped ambush. They allowed the Americans to walk in. And then when the unit was fully in, they opened fire on three sides. The NVA would cut through the defense columns. American troops, though, were well trained. They got down on the ground and they formed pocket perimeters. Problem is you're in the middle of this grass. It gets pitch dark. There's no streets. There's no lights. And in the middle of the night, the VC came out and started attacking them, engaged in hand-to-hand combat. Soon, the guys on the front and on the back, they could hear the cries and the death of the guys in the middle. But they weren't going to pick up from their positions and go and help. It was pitch dark. Because the NVA began picking them off one by one. The only thing that saved them was McDade put in a call. Broken Arrow. Does anyone know what the significance of that is? That's the call you put in when the enemy is in your position. You are basically calling upon the air support to pound your position. So, the Sky Raiders come in, they begin dropping napalm, and B-52s high up fly over, and they begin pounding the position.
Well, when all the shit's hitting the fan and all the explosions occurring, Tully realizes something's wrong, and he comes racing towards McDade's forces. But when the sun came up on November 18th, the realization of what took place became apparent. McDade's 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry, decimated. Of the 450 men in the battalion, 155 were killed in action, 124 men were wounded. On the NVA side, 407 were killed, 150 were wounded. But when the air cav came in and pulled the guys out, the one thing they didn't realize was that the Americans managed to kill over 50% of the NVA in the area. So statistically, it was a huge hit. Questions? Almost done. All right. Well, when looking at the outcome, the reactions on both sides are significant. When Moore was extracted and returned to base, Secretary of Defense McNamara put a call through and had a conversation with Moore directly. Moore basically described to McNamara what the NVA were doing. He described in detail. You have these soldiers running down the mountain, screaming at the top of their lungs, engaged in this human wave assault. The likes which hadn't been seen since the Americans first landed in Korea. This apparently shook McNamara to the core. Because he suddenly realized that if the North Vietnamese are willing to do that, to die in mass at a death rate of 10 to 1 and still fight, how are we going to win this? Soon his tone to LBJ began to change. McNamara was always the guy since Kennedy. He was saying, we can win this, we can win this. But after his first conversation with Moore, his first report to the president, suddenly declared, this is going to be a long war, Mr. President. As for Westmoreland, this was a huge win for Westmoreland strategy. American forces engaged. They killed the enemy, and they controlled the battlefield. They also had a favorable kill ratio. Statistically, this is a win. But in this one operation, more American soldiers died than had died in Vietnam going back to 1960. 237 American flag-draped coffins would be shipped home. While Westmoreland said, oh, this is a statistic victory, the one thing he didn't count on was that there would be news reporters at the military base when the planes with these coffins began to arrive. And they were taking pictures. And they were taking video. Plus, all of the battlefield pictures I showed, Moore allowed a reporter to actually be embedded. So those were actual battlefield pictures. and they were printed in the newspapers. Which meant not only were Americans seeing flag-draped coffins, but they were seeing combat. Not the type of combat they saw in the newsreels from World War II, which actually didn't show battlefield. It showed the American guys going like, yeah, this is great. Same thing in Korea. But no, for the first time, this would be a war that would be broadcast into the homes of the American people. And when they put on the TV at night, they could see the war. And let me tell you, Americans tend not to care about statistics. They tend not to think, hoorah, our guys killed 10 of theirs to every one of ours. No, they look at it as 237 lives lost. So the problem with Vietnam also took root in 65. To win, you needed to kill more enemy. To kill more enemy, that meant you were going to suffer more casualties. And the more American GIs that came home in coffins, the more the Americans would turn against the war. As for the leaders in Hanoi, they looked at it completely opposite. Yes, they were amazed at how much firepower the Americans had. They were amazed at the mobility. They never thought in a million years Y Trang would ever be it. But yet the Americans got there. And if the Americans could get there, that meant the Americans could get anywhere. They also recognized the heavy losses that they suffered. So, they began to be debates. Maybe this human wave strikes, this is not the way to go. Maybe instead of launching these large-scale operations, maybe we should start using more guerrilla tactics. Because maybe we're not going to be able to beat the Americans on the battlefield. But if we can kill enough of them, maybe we can turn the American people against the war. And a nation cannot win a war when the people turn against it. So just as Westmoreland was gearing up for more fighting, the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese were like, okay, here we go. Let's do it. Questions? Exam number 3 is probably going to be next week. Paper is due April 22nd. Your final exam is it the Thursday or the Tuesday of final week? I forget. But it's one of the two. See ya.
Question about the exam.
Yes. For
FDIC.
The final?
No, for the next test that we have for this class.
How long are you going to be gone for?
Just a week.
No, that's fine. I didn't see an email, but that's fine. Right. It's going to be remote, so.
I should still be able to take it, but I won't be in class that week.
That's fine. I'll double check. I don't remember seeing it, but then again, I don't think I checked the email since last week, so. Would it have gone out recently?
Either today or sometime during this week.
Yeah, that's a school-related function, so we'll give you excused absences, and you can take it whenever you're ready to take it.
All right, thank you.
Yep.